Life as a Nephrologist, a podcast series by the National Kidney Foundation. I'm Laura Brereton, Director of our Clinical Practice Guideline Development Program, KDOQI. Our goal with this podcast is to take a look at nephrology as a career and to encourage medical students and residents to choose it. We're exploring what day-to-day life is like for nephrologists at different points in their careers and highlighting their varying interests, projects, and stories. Today, I'm talking with Dr. Andrew Bomback, who is an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and a specialist in glomerular diseases. He's also a writer, having published in the Los Angeles Review of Books, The Atlantic, and the Kenyon Review, among others. His recently published book is entitled Doctor. It's part of a series called Object Lessons by Bloomsbury, short books that are part memoir, part nonfiction, each looking at the hidden lives of an everyday object or concept. We'll talk about that book, as well as his thoughts on working as both a physician and a writer. Hello, Andy. Welcome to the Life as a Nephrologist podcast.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being on. So to start, let's talk about you. To give a bit of your book away, you grew up with a pediatrician father who was quite well known in your community in New York. Whom you adored, and you pretty much always knew that you would go into medicine. But what led you to specialize in nephrology?
Well, I think my first branching point, which was a big decision, was to decide I wanted to do adult medicine versus pediatrics. And I realized that I wanted to do that when I did my pediatrics rotation and just didn't feel comfortable talking to parents of sick children. Which is ironic because now as a nephrologist, I have so many young patients that I often find myself talking to parents of relatively young people. But that was my first decision process. And then I started residency really with an open mind and actually thought I would be a generalist. And a lot of times it's just serendipity who your mentors become. I had amazing mentors in nephrology who basically took me under their wing as a doctor, not necessarily as a nephrologist, but basically said, this is how I'm a doctor and this is how I approach patients. And I followed their lead. And then eventually they said, well, maybe you would like nephrology since you seem interested in these processes. When I was a second year resident, my division invited me to the American Society of Nephrology Renal Week to give me a better glimpse of what a career as a nephrologist could be. I think now there's actually like a more formal program. I think it's called like ASN STARS. But back then it was a little bit unusual to have residents go to ASN, but I went, I had a great time with the division. I remember calling my then girlfriend, now wife, and just saying, I think I'm going to go into nephrology. And she just thought it was the strangest thing because she was like, you've always said you wanted to be a hospitalist or a generalist. Like you've always talked about like not wanting to subspecialize. And now these guys take you on a meeting and wine and dine you. And all of a sudden you want to become a nephrologist, but it wasn't as frivolous as that. I had actually really been thinking about what a nephrologist does. And what really appealed to me was that a nephrologist took care of really sick patients, but also did so in a way that respected the entire part of the body, not just the kidney. I've always felt that nephrologists are sort of part-time generalists anyway, because you can't really deal with kidney disease without knowing everything about your patient.
Yeah. Okay. So it sounds like you had that early exposure, and that program I think is called Kidney Stars and it's still going.
Kidney Stars, right.
So you ended up not only not being the rural general practitioner you thought you would be, but you are a subspecialist. So you specialize in glomerular diseases. Can you tell me a bit about what those are and what interests you in them?
Yes. So glomerular diseases are essentially rare kidney disorders that primarily affect the glomeruli or filters of the kidney. Most of them we chalk up as being autoimmune in nature, although more and more of them are now being discovered as being genetic in etiology. But essentially, these are sort of the zebras as opposed to the horses of nephrology. These are diseases like minimal change disease, FSGS, membranous nephropathy, IgA nephropathy, lupus nephritis, ANCA-associated glomerulonephritis, and some rare entities. But essentially, they're the types of rare diseases that I think for more general nephrologists sort of are interspersed with their day. So they might have a day of clinic where they only see one glomerular disease patient. Whereas my clinic, because it's such a subspecialty within a subspecialty, My clinic, 90 to 100% of the patients will come in with a diagnosis already established of a glomerular disease. So I'm seeing patients who are referred to me by other nephrologists who are looking for some help with these diseases that they don't see that often. And so I'm fortunate enough to work at an academic center where we have an established center for these diseases, where we've been doing research on these diseases. We have clinical trials ongoing for these diseases, and we just have a huge experience treating these patients. And many nephrologists are looking to us to help them with cases that they don't normally see.
Okay. So would you say your patients are generally younger than the more usual nephrology population?
Yeah. So I think that's actually one of the more, you know, enjoyable aspects of my clinical job, is that I'm often taking care of patients in their late teens, their 20s, their 30s, early 40s, as opposed to many CKD clinics where so many of the patients are in the later years of their life. And whenever I have residents or fellows rotate with me in my clinic, that's always their first comment about the clinic, is they say, "Wow, your patients are so young," because these glomerular diseases do often have their onset in childhood or teenage years or early adulthood. And so there's definitely a role for having a specialist who's really, you know, attuned to those time periods. And I think, you know, pediatric nephrologists are extremely comfortable with that. But as an adult nephrologist, if you don't see these patients that often, you can sort of lose track of what it's like to be a 20-year-old who's sick or a 30-year-old who's sick. Whereas I see so many of these patients, I'm constantly thinking about how's school, how's your relationships, how's your new job, all the things that seem to be like the normal trials of being a 20 and 30 year old, they're compounded when you have to deal with a chronic illness and the treatments of the chronic illness.
Right. It's a really specialized set of problems. So what extra training does a nephrologist need in order to take on this subspecialization? Is it formal, or is this something you took on yourself by taking special cases?
There are some formal glomerular fellowships. I did one of them here at Columbia. I know that there are a number of other centers around the country, and at least one in Canada that does a formal glomerular fellowship year. And they're becoming more and more popular because academic centers are really excited about having dedicated glomerular specialists working for them and developing glomerular centers similar to what we have here. So many of our former glomerular fellows who trained at Columbia have now moved on to other hospitals and have started their own glomerular fellowships to build up their own glomerular program. So it's becoming more and more of a common track that if you want to do glomerular disease, you do an extra year after regular fellowship to specialize in glomerular disease. That being said, it's not a sine qua non. You can say, "I want to specialize in glomerular disease," and not do a formal fellowship. It's not like there's a, you know, accreditation board. And really the most important thing about the glomerular fellowship year, which is something that you could do on your own, is just the experience of just seeing so many patients. So in my glomerular fellowship year, you know, I just felt like I had seen more glomerular disease in 2 or 3 months than I had seen all of fellowship. And at the end of the glomerular fellowship year at Columbia, we always tell our departing fellows, like, there's pretty much nothing that you will see afterwards that you didn't see this year. Because you get this incredible exposure to so many cases in a short period of time.
Right, because all of those cases are referred to you guys at that specialized unit.
Exactly, yeah. And very often you get referred the most complicated cases, because if you have a very straightforward glomerular disease, most nephrologists will feel comfortable dealing with those, starting first-line therapy. And very often the cases that are referred to us are the much more complicated versions of those cases. So I sort of use this analogy, like doing glomerular diseases at a glomerular center like ours is sort of like training for a marathon in Kenya, you know, with the altitude change. And then when you actually get a straightforward glomerular disease patient, like a new onset membranous with very mild proteinuria, or a brand new IgA nephropathy with just a little bit of hematuria and proteinuria, those cases seem like exorbitantly easy because you've trained with such harder cases.
So you're in New York City at Columbia, and this is an area where there are a lot of nephrologists, being in a huge metropolitan area. Do you think that nephrologists practicing in cities need to develop this subspecialization or any subspecialization in order to be successful?
I think that there it's probably an easier route to be successful, you know, to find, like, I remember when I was a fellow, which was not in New York, but when I was a fellow, my division chief said, you know, you need to find your niche, you need to find your role, you need to find something where somebody says, that's Andy Bombeck, he's good at X, and you need to insert X. I do think that's probably the easiest route to getting an established career in academic nephrology. That being said, you know, some of the best academic nephrologists that I know, and the ones, for example, who when I was a resident, who made me want to go into nephrology, did not have such a obviously defined niche. They were good at everything. They might be more, you know, seasoned in certain parts, but I would not have said, oh, that's Dr. X, he's good at Y for them. You know, I think they were more of a general nephrologist. So I think you can do it both ways. But I do think if you do have a very specific niche, it does become a much easier way to establish yourself in an academic division.
That makes sense. So if we switch gears and we'll go to writing, which is exciting because you are a physician, a nephrologist, but you also have a successful writing career going on. And I've talked to a lot of younger nephrologists in my work and through doing this podcast, and people want to do this. I think this is an up and coming thing, and especially at Columbia where you are, they focus a lot on humanities and writing. So how do you find time among all your clinical work? How do you find the time for your writing?
Oh, thanks. So I mean, the one thing I would say is the one part of my plans for my career that I was able to maintain. So as you alluded to, when I started training, my thoughts were I'll be a generalist, a rural physician, or a hospitalist. But the idea was that I would have a really sort of codified time for practicing medicine and an equally codified time to write. And I don't have that now as a nephrologist, but I did sort of try to figure out a way to carve away dedicated time for writing. So for me, it's entirely on my commutes. So I live in a suburb of New York, so I have somewhere between 25 to 45 minutes of train time back and forth each day, during which I do the bulk of my writing, my editing, and oftentimes the reading that informs my writing. And it's very unusual that I do any dedicated writing outside of being on a Metro North or a subway car. Maybe like a long plane trip when I'm going to do like a conference or to give a lecture, I can get a lot of work done on a plane. You know, when I go down to NIH, I have 4 hours on Amtrak during which I can do writing. But the real like daily writing that I do is entirely done on my commute back and forth to work. And there's a little bit of a compromise I made. There was a time during fellowship where I used all that time to read journals, and I have significantly cut down on my journal reading. So I, you know, to build up the writing time, I have cut back on some of the time that would normally be used to read journals. So I used to like read, you know, AJKD and C. Jason cover to cover. And now I really just read the articles that interest me. So that, you know, I've lost out on that to be able to find the time to write. But obviously the writing has been really important to me, and actually has, I think, helped me as a doctor to explore some of my feelings as a physician. So I think it was a relatively worthwhile trade-off.
Yeah, I was going to say it is a trade-off, but it does sound like a worthwhile one. And you talk about it helping you as a physician, and that is something that the Columbia and other medical schools focus on now, using the interpretation of literature and the looking into different characters and things that you face as a human, and how you can explore that as a doctor. Do you find that your colleagues are interested in writing now as well? Do people ask you about it, how they can get involved, students or colleagues?
Yeah, students and colleagues have talked to me about it, sort of said what steps did you take? A lot of it is logistics, like when do you find the time to write? But as their writing starts to pick up, they'll ask questions about where should I submit this? Like, do you think this is a reasonable thing to write about? I do think there's a lot of doctors out there who use writing probably the same way that I do, which is sort of a way to process what we see and what frustrates us, what motivates us, what sort of parts of medicine we wish non-doctors knew about. So I think, there are probably other venues and other ways that you, a physician can handle, those feelings. Writing isn't the only way, but it's definitely a very practical way. And I think a very healthy way to process it. I'm sure there's some doctors who just say like, oh, I got to go to the gym and pump iron, I'm going to go, buy lots of fancy food items and cook a gourmet meal. Whatever their hobby is an outlet to deal with, the job, because what we see as physicians can be really overwhelming. But for me, it's always been writing.
Yeah, that's really important, because you're right. You see things in the course of your daily work that other humans do not, life and death, and that not so pretty parts in between are part of what you face. So I'm really glad that literature and writing and expressing oneself is being embraced like that. So you have written a book, which was just published in September. It's part of a series called Object Lessons, published by Bloomsbury. And each of these books focuses on an object or a concept in our society that maybe people have never really thought about beyond its surface level. So I think there's one on blankets, there's one on toast, and yours is called doctor. You look at the concept of a doctor and the way it's perceived in our society and put it in the context of a memoir. So it's a bit about your experience growing up with a doctor father and becoming a doctor yourself. And I would say the focus of it was really on how the experience of being a doctor wasn't exactly as you expected it to be or as society expects it to be. And one thing you bring up over and over is that physicians are presented in the media and television as being overly confident and ever pleasant and kind of talking with what you call a television doctor voice. I'm wondering if you still think today that patients expect that from their doctors, or if your colleagues feel that same pressure to present themselves this way. And if so, where do you think it comes from?
I do. I mean, I think, and it probably is not unique to medicine. I think we all have sort of preconceived notions of what we want out of certain roles. And, I think, I'll just use the example of yesterday, I had a babysitter come over to take care of my kids. And it's going to sound really shallow, but I saw her take out of her bag, a bag of flaming hot Cheetos and this blue sugary drink. And I was just like, oh, this is not the babysitter I want. It was just purely based on the fact that she was eating such unhealthy food. And I was like, I'm entrusting my kids to this unhealthy person. And had she taken out of her bag, a kale salad and some mineral water, I probably would have felt better. So I think we all have our, inherent biases about what we want out of the service workers that we're exposed to. In many ways, physicians are service workers. And I know I begin the book, there's an introduction, but the real first chapter of the book is when I was a surgery resident and my hair was really long and I hadn't shaved for a while. And my surgery preceptor, who was a cardiothoracic surgeon, and he could have been straight out of casting of Grey's Anatomy. He was really tall, really good looking. He had a South African accent. We all talked about this is the coolest guy ever. We were if he wasn't a doctor, he could be a fighter pilot or something like that. He was just a really classy, polished guy. And he just pulled me aside and he was just like, you look like a slob. And even though you're doing really good work, your patients don't want slobs as doctors. They want the doctors that they see on TV. He's like, so, get a haircut, shave, just look nicer. And to some degree, it sounds really superficial, but I do think it is true. I think patients want at their heart, they want the doctor who's going to take the best care of them, who's going to care the most for them. And they'll take somebody wearing shorts and a t-shirt if that's the doctor that is doing it. But especially with first impressions, I think it's really important that we show them that we respect our position by looking presentable. You know, I have patients now that I've known for years who, when they see me wearing like a tie and a sports coat, they're like, oh, something must be going on today. You look nice. So like, they clearly know me well to know that like, I'm more casual in my appearance for the most part. But when I first meet a new patient, like I think they really want to see me looking like a doctor, just to have more confidence in what they're about to embark upon.
Okay. And with your students and fellows, do you convey that same message that your former attending had conveyed to you?
I convey a slightly different message. I don't really get too much into physical appearance as much as that surgeon did, because I think physical appearance can be really a touchy subject, especially with trainees. So I never really tell them, oh, you need to cut your hair or take out that piercing or don't show that tattoo, because I do think there's a degree of individual expression that I don't want to step on. But I very often will give them pointers on the way they speak to patients and the way that they convey information to patients, which I think is the real crucial part of being a doctor, is that communication piece. And I often will tell them, you want to make sure that the way you communicate to the patients is a way that makes them feel better. You know, there's like one part of the book where I talk about hospital slogans, and I mention a memoir by the cardiologist Bernard Laun, and how he says that one of his colleagues, who's a Serbian physician, has the saying that every time a patient sees a doctor, they should feel better afterwards. And I was like, that should be the universal hospital slogan. Every time a patient sees a doctor, they should feel better afterwards. And I've often told my fellows or my residents or my students, make sure when you're talking to a patient, even if you're conveying news that they don't want to hear, you're doing so in a way that's compassionate, that is professional, and that packages the information in a way that can make this patient feel better, even if they're feeling better just because they have more knowledge. So I will often critique the way they quote unquote present themselves via language. I almost never do it on appearance.
Yeah, I agree. That's what I would say too, as both a colleague and a patient. It's that presentation of care overall, caring about the person. So you talk a bit about society's perceptions. What other ways do you think we as a society perceive a doctor to be that doesn't match with the lived experience of doctors?
I think there's definitely a misconnect between what patients think doctors can do and what doctors are able to do, and especially in certain instances. Like, I think that in many instances, like, patients are surprised when doctors say there's nothing more I can do. Like, this is especially relevant in kidney disease, when you say we've reached a point of no return and this kidney is going to fail. I think oftentimes patients are surprised to hear a doctor essentially give up on an organ. I think there is a bit of a disconnect too in terms of patients processing the limitations of what a doctor's time is. You know, I have some patients who express like disbelief that, you know, they got the answering service on a weekend, or that when they called at midnight, they got a fellow rather than me. And I feel like asking them, like, you know, what do you think happens that when I leave the office? You know, like I do have a life outside of the clinic. And so I think a lot of it is just sort of, again, there's a degree of communication, you know, to tell a patient, when you call this number on a night or a weekend, there's a good chance you're not going to get me directly, but you'll get somebody who works with me, who can communicate with me. And, you know, you're not being abandoned, but you don't get me 24/7. I try to get a little bit into this in the book when I talk about concierge physicians and concierge medicine, because there's obviously an appeal of concierge medicine. Like, it is becoming more popular. And like, when I first heard of the concept, I thought this would be just like a very unique, only for the super wealthy patient, because I didn't think it was really sustainable. I didn't think there were enough doctors who would be willing to do it, nor did I think there'd be enough patients who'd want to pay to do it. But the fact that more and more people are entering into concierge type relationships with physicians suggests to me that patients really like this idea of a 24/7 doctor. And in the book, what I try to sort of explore is that I think the doctors of my previous generations, like my dad, actually were closer to this 24/7 doctor than doctors of my generation, and definitely even less so with the doctors who are coming up through training, where we've really made an emphasis that for their own mental health, they need to have some limitations on how long they're in the hospital, how much they think about, you know, their job. We encourage them to have outside interests. Like here at Columbia, you know, the students put on plays, they play in orchestras, they play, you know, club sports, they do charity work, but we are, you know, constantly encouraging them to do something other than medicine to keep themselves somewhat more rounded than just being a 24/7 doctor. Like, I don't think the types of, you know, doctors that my dad was or people of his generation were, you know, like their pleasure reading was medical journals. Like they, you know, looked forward to getting phone calls at night, even when they weren't on call. I just don't think that model really exists now, and that probably for a good reason. I think, you know, we want to have physicians who feel like they have a life.
Right. Really just embracing your full humanity, because, you know, your patients are human, but you are as well. And I think, as you alluded to before, that I think that probably will translate back into being a better doctor when you have more in your life. And you address a lot that in your book, as well as the concept of the doctor-patient relationship that comes up in many chapters. And I think one of my favorite parts of your book is the story of your son's birth, probably because both of my children were also almost born in triage, so I related to that. But you and your wife get to the hospital and there are no labor and delivery rooms available, so you're afraid the baby's about to be born in triage, and it ends up that just at the last minute, an obstetrician swoops in and delivers him right there in triage, saves the day, and you're both ecstatic and very happy. And this woman is kind of a bit of a hero to you both as patients. You hadn't met her before, didn't know, and then she leaves again. So you have this memory of her as this doctor hero in a way, kind of like the television doctors. But you work there at the hospital too, so you run into her a few months later in an elevator, but she doesn't see you, and I suppose she's talking to someone else and starts talking about her dating life just as you were about to say hi and maybe complaining about some bad dates or something. And then you feel like your hero vision of her is suddenly dashed and you can't say hi anymore. So and then she leaves, and I don't know if you ever saw her again, but I just remember thinking at that moment, like, is there a way for her to have been both? Can she be that hero and still have some bad dates? You know, can she kind of maintain that humanness and also be that great doctor to you?
I would love to say yes, because that's sort of what I would hope as a doctor. But I know, like, because I was in the patient role in that interaction, I really like held on with great pleasure to this idea of her being a superhero. Because she was so amazing during the delivery. Like, every time I talk about the delivery, I get like choked up, because it was like we were so panicked that, like, this delivery, like, they literally did not have an OB until like the baby's head was crowning, because it was just the craziest day that day. Like, they were just saying, like, we've never had a day like this. And so, like, this OB just sweeps in at the last moment. Like, I think she barely had time to put like sterile gloves on. And then the baby came out like within like a minute. And then all of a sudden she was like, somebody needs to find a resident. I'm not doing the afterbirth, you know, like, she's like, and then she's gone. And she was just like, but she was like so amazing. Like, that sounds like she was like really crass. She wasn't. She was like, oh, here you go, mom. Here you go, dad. Congratulations. Like, she did everything right. But she was like in and out in like a minute or two. It was like totally superhero style. And we ended up telling the story so many times because it was such an unusual, you know, delivery story. And I think every time we told her, like, she just became like more and more the superhero. And I just like loved, maybe it was just like refreshing to me to see a doctor as a hero, because so much of my professional life is that I see the limitations of doctors. Like, so whether it's a doctor referring me a case because he or she doesn't know how to handle it or has mismanaged it, or my own patients that I'm managing are just not doing well. I have this like joke with my fellows when they get upset, like, it's like the patient's body's not cooperating with our brains, you know, like, it's just not working, you know? And then you're constantly processing like our non-heroic feats as a physician. And then here I am in the role of a patient, like, this is a pure hero. Like, she did everything to help us. And like, she did it like not asking for a single thank you. Like, she was just an amazing hero. And so, and I think that it's like such a, it's such a great feeling to have a hero like that. And so to see it deflated in the elevator, because the thing was, like, I was so excited when I saw her on the elevator, because I was going to tell her, I was going to remind her the story, and I was going to like brag to my wife that I saw her. Like, it's almost like she's a celebrity. I was so excited about this. And then to like, just as I'm about to talk, she starts like going into a bad date, and like, you know, and she has every right to do it. It was a doctor's elevator. So it wasn't like she was like doing this in front of patients necessarily, but it was deflating to me, which, you know, again, goes back to what I was saying earlier. There's a big disconnect between patient and doctor. Like, we expect so many things out of our doctors when we're patients, and patients, I think, expect our doctors to be these like immortal gods and goddesses sometimes. And it, and we just, we don't, we should, we can't, and we shouldn't as doctors live up to those expectations. It's, they're unfair expectations. And I was unfair to that doctor to be upset that she was talking about a date on the elevator. But I can't undo my feelings.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that that was your moment to be a patient. And that,
yeah,
I think that's a big problem. You talk about through the book that physicians today, and probably in the past too, have such an identity around their profession. So even though we are all patients by nature, you know, if you live in this society, you're probably getting healthcare yourself. It's difficult to let go of that professional identity. And I think it's harmful in a way, you know, when you can't turn that off. I know you talk a lot in the book about your experiences with your infant son and trying to get his dairy allergy diagnosed. And that was really stressful. And you and your wife are bringing home hemocult strips and really not being able to turn off that that physician part of your brain. What do you think it is, or do you think it's a part of medical culture that really makes physicians feel that they can't be patients, that there is that disconnect? Because I feel that a lot in talking with people.
Well, I don't know if I had to cut a lot of stuff out of the book, so I always worry if, like, if I remember correctly, if something was in the book or not in the book. But I have actually a section that I wrote about how physicians are really bad patients. And a lot of it is just like, you know, that old analogy, like, if you know how the sausage is made, you wouldn't want to eat it. And a lot of times I think, like, as a physician, we know, like, deep down that there are limitations in medicine. Like, we know deep down that sometimes things go well or go poorly, completely out of the control of the doctor. And so when we're in that position where we're seeing a doctor try to skirt that dynamic, like, if I can tell, like, I saw a podiatrist who was like trying to help me with plantar fasciitis. And it was weird because it was right in the process as I was sort of doing a lot of editing on the book. So I was really like attuned to a doctor's language. And the podiatrist was like telling me, he's like, oh, you shouldn't have plantar fasciitis. Like, you're too young and you're too thin to have that. And I was just like, he's using flattery now to gain my trust. And then he talked about, then he said, I'm going to, you know, but I think an orthotic will be perfect for you. And I'm going to design one exactly for you. And I'm going to actually have them rush it. And the whole time I was just like, this is almost like a sales act, because he probably gives everybody an orthotic and he's not going to rush it. Like, he said he's going to get it for me in 2 weeks, but I bet you the average turnaround time for all of these are 2 weeks. But this idea that he was sort of playing to my expectancy would help. And I'm not trying to fault him on this. I do the exact same thing when I talk to patients about things like their labs or their medicines. You know, there is a degree of salesmanship that comes with being a caregiver. I think it is hard to let go of, because you know that some of it is a little bit of a sales pitch. And I just remember, like, with my son, with the allergy issues in the beginning, like, the conversations we had with his pediatrician were really sort of like one doctor to another, where she was saying, oh yeah, like, we'll try cutting out this. But then there was some point where I could tell she didn't feel like she had a good grasp of it, and she wanted to refer him to an allergist. And I just remember she used the type of words that you would just use for a run-of-the-mill patient. You wouldn't use it for a physician. She said, you know, I think we should ask for some help from a specialist. And, like, that's not the way you would talk physician to physician. That's the way you would talk to a patient. And it was funny, because, like, all of a sudden I realized, all right, the dynamic has changed. This is no longer a doctor-to-doctor conversation. This is, I'm the doctor, you're the patient, and I need to sell you something. And it was interesting.
That is so interesting. So you talk throughout the book about all of these difficulties, I guess, of being a physician today that perhaps you didn't know before going to medical school, or that maybe many people don't think about. A lot of, all the time spent on the computer, and just that you spend so much time talking. I think you said in the beginning, what do I really do? I talk to patients. What kind of person or what characteristics do you think someone should have today to really enjoy being a physician?
That's a great question. I think, and to get to what you were saying, I do think, like, at its heart, my book is about communication between doctors and patients. And I think as I wrote the book, I actually realized that is really what a doctor does. Like, beyond, there are some exceptions, but like, for the most part, a physician's main job is to communicate to a patient. And I think if you want to be a really good doctor, your charge is to be good at talking to people. And, this doesn't mean like you need to be good at a cocktail party. Like I'm awful, talking to strangers at a party, or, like I always like feel embarrassed. Like when I go to the barber, like everybody has a great conversation with the barber and I say nothing. I think I even wrote once about like how I was like jealous of like the other Metro North passengers, because they like the conductor knows them, and like like they have these conversations every time he clips their ticket, and like he just looks at mine and walks past me. So I'm not like a very like outgoing social person, but in a clinic room or in a hospital room, somehow like all of that melts away, and I can just, I feel able to connect with people. And if you can't do that, there are ways to be a doctor, but you probably shouldn't be the type who's dealing with patients on a regular basis. Like, there are other venues to be a physician, but if you really want to be the kind of like doctor's doctor, you have to be able to feel comfortable just sitting down, talking to a patient, letting that patient tell you everything in his or her life that can be extremely hard, really private. But it's just an incredible privilege to hear those things. And you need to be able to bounce it back. You need to be able to take what they tell you and then talk really well in return. And in some respects, it's not that different, from other jobs. Like you wouldn't want, a school teacher who couldn't do that. You wouldn't want, an accountant who couldn't do that. But when it's somebody's health, when it's somebody's, potential life on the line, you want to make sure that the person in the room can receive information appropriately and then return the dialogue in a very effective way. And I think medical schools have really worked on trying to improve this. It's to some degree, there's an inherent gift that certain people have. I don't think I'm necessarily one of them. I've worked really hard at trying to be a good communicator. As I mentioned in the book, sometimes I even do like a fake voice just to really make sure I'm communicating well. Like I call it my Don Draper voice, like the guy from Mad Men. Not that he's such a saintly guy, but he really knows how to like to talk in one of those sales meetings. Like he can just sell anything. And so sometimes I'll just like use this like this much deeper baritone voice. But I think there are definitely ways for, even if you're not a natural, that you can improve your style with patients. And so now we do these sort of like simulated patient videos where we watch medical students talking to patients. We critique them afterwards, not just what they're saying, but what their body language is communicating. So I think some of it can be learned, but yeah. Some people are just born to be comfortable around other people. And those people are particularly good at doctoring.
Okay. It just sounds like you, besides being good at it, you really have to enjoy that aspect of communication in some sense, that hearing and bearing witness to someone else's story.
Yeah.
Well, just to wrap up, we addressed this before, but do you think it's important to modern physician well-being or work satisfaction to have something else besides being a doctor, and to kind of perceive yourself as a doctor and something else, so a physician and a writer, or a physician and a runner? What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I personally do. Obviously, I'm a little biased because I try to maintain like another life as a writer, but I do think it's really important just for your own sanity to do that, but also just for your own sense of identity. Like, I get a little bit of this into the book, that the older doctors who might not have had such a, you know, extra hospital or extra clinic life, it might be hard for them to sort of transition out of work, because like, what else is there to do? If you define yourself as like, my main purpose on life is to be a doctor, at some point when you're facing retirement, it can be difficult to think about, well, if I'm not a doctor, am I still worthwhile? And I think to some degree, my dad is struggling with that. Amazingly, he's like sort of now in a semi retirement phase, where he's gone from 100% to 50% time. And it's been really great, because his new hobby is sort of his grandkids. So he sort of filled that time with just being more involved with his grandkids, which is a really nice way to fill your time. And I think he's starting to enjoy the free time away from the clinic and not taking as much call. But like, I often say, like, well, I can't wait till I'm retired. I'm just going to write. It's just like, you know, like, I think it's a great idea to have these interests outside of medicine. But you, like, it doesn't have to be in the form of writing, like you alluded to. Like, I know doctors who like are marathoners. I know doctors who are gourmet cooks. I know doctors who, you know, play in bands. I know doctors who, you know, just read voraciously. Like my wife, you know, like her main hobby is just reading. Like she she's in too many book clubs to even think. Like, if I told you how many book clubs you were, you'd think it was a joke. Like she keeps book diaries. She goes to readings. Like, she just loves literature. So I do think it's important to have something outside of the daily grind of medicine. And then, of course, like, the biggest thing is having a family. Like, if you have the interests of your kids that you can just sort of say, okay, like, I'm going to get away from, you know, all the sickness, all the sadness of the hospital, and just watch my kid try to play violin, or my kid try to go up the ladder at the playground this weekend. And, you know, you can get these little victories in their lives that sustain you. It's always very, very positive in that respect.
That's wonderful. And I'll put the link to your book. It's called Doctor, published by Bloomsbury, into our notes for this episode. Thank you so much, Andy, for talking with me today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on. It was really nice to talk to you, and I hope the conversation is inspiring to your listeners. I
hope so too. The National Kidney Foundation wants to hear from our listeners. If you are a medical student or resident considering nephrology, and you have a question about working in the field, or if you'd like to come on the podcast and talk about your career as a nephrologist, please email us at nkfpodcast@kidney.org. Thank you.